Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Dan Behar, better known as Destroyer, to hear about his forthcoming album, Have We Met?
Then we'll be discussing business, art and the selling of souls as we meet CEO turned artist Philip Hum and Martin Hancock, the star of his new film, The Last Faust.
And with Christmas on the horizon, we'll be taking the temperature of contemporary spirituality as we meet author and priest Marie Elsa Bragg.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today. And we've got some great music for you too right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Haven't seen you around these parts for a while, Tom.
It's been too long since I renewed my acquaintance with the good ship Monocle Weekly Org, and I'm delighted to be back, particularly this week. There's some festive cheer in the air, around and about. No strangers to it here at Midori House, of course. We had a bit of a Christmas jolly for our colleagues from around the world who flew in to join us this week. I'm feeling a little festive, I'm going to be honest. Are you fully prepared? You're a man who strikes me will leave his shopping, for example, to the very last minute.
Yes, I will be doing that. But I enjoy the rush. I like the deadline. It makes me feel alive, Tom. How about you? Have you got all your offspring's presents?
Very much about forward planning.
What are you getting them?
Well, I can't say, can I?
They're not listening to this.
This is the least highbrow of the programming that they enjoy on a regular basis, especially the 18-month-old. No, they're going to have a very merry Christmas, as are we. What's the kind of festive cheer on this week's edition of The Weekly? Got anything that you're particularly excited about?
Well, next week, Tom, I'm gonna answer that in a kind of politician's way of answering it.
Go on.
Next week, we're going to have an extremely festive episode. We'll be talking about Christmas ghosts. We'll be looking at Christmas cocktails.
Oh, sounds good.
And we'll be talking to a man who translated an ancient book of demons and magic spells, which speaks to the pagan origin of Christmas.
Indeed.
Of the festive season. That's next week. This week, I thought, you know, we talk about presents, we talk about food, we talk about drink. We don't talk that much about the spiritual underpinnings of Christmas. You don't have to be religious to be spiritual, is my view on this.
Absolutely.
So this week, we're going to have an author who's also a priest. She's actually the duty chaplain of Westminster Abbey and has released a new book, a very interesting book, beautifully written. So we're going to be talking to Marie Elsa Bragg later on. That's going to be the Christmas injection for this week.
I am very much looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to hearing from Fernando Augusto Pacheco in just a minute with next week's news. If we do take a forward-looking stance for a moment, or is it too soon for me to ask you about your 2020 vision, as it were?
Very good. That was very, very good.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a bit early, actually.
Okay, well, you've killed that one.
How about you, Tom?
I'm all about the future, mate. Do you know what I am? Future-proof.
What have you got planned?
I'm telling you, I'm future-proof.
Have you got a bunker in New Zealand? Have you buried guns and dry food?
There may be a bunker involved. Hunker down. Listen, we had, what was it, the third general election in just a few years here in the UK this week. Yeah. We're not talking about it. There's a full amnesty on that. It's a ban. Outright ban on talking about it. I've had enough of those. If there's any more general elections, I'm out of here. Here's a man, though, who always has his finger on the pulse. Whether it's politics or parakeets, it's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando.
Hello, everyone. I'm feeling very festive today, actually. Even my news look ahead is quite festive.
Faye, can I say you're one of the few people who brings Christmas cheer into the radio studio, even in the height of summer?
Exactly. Well, thank you for that.
It's true. Santa in short shorts.
I would like to see that, actually. In Brazil, actually, occasionally we do get some of those. But, you know, guys, I love elections, but actually there's no elections on my look ahead.
Thank goodness for that, Faye. Can I say that?
Can we keep it very simple? Let's keep it very nice. We like to listen to music. Friday, it's when the official Christmas number one is released here in the UK. And it's such a tradition in the UK. I think it's been going on for 65 years.
Wow.
And, you know, of course, recently you had this kind of X Factor winners, but come on, the Pet Shop Boys had the Christmas number one. There's a rich history here in this country. Only last year, do you remember who was number one last year, actually?
Was it Rage Against the Machine?
Not quite, but it was Lead Baby, the U tuber, you know, he's kind of a dad, and he re-recorded the song We Built This City. And this year he's a contender again to be number one with a song called I Love Sausage Rolls, which again took some inspiration of Joan Jett's classic I Love Rock and Roll. That's actually apparently the favorite.
Wow, they have got into doing, you know, the Pet Shop Boys, quite a good musical duo.
Amazing.
Among the best of the 20th century. They've got into novelty acts, haven't they, for the Christmas number one?
Yeah.
The Rage Against the Machine thing was subversive in the extreme, if you remember that.
Was that Christmas number one?
Yeah, it was a huge campaign to knock Leona Lewis or whomever it was off the top spot. They didn't want X Factors winning, and so they got Rage Against the Machine to win. Is there any of that kind of subversive, we're going to mess things up this year attitude being brought to this? And what do you think of that attitude?
Well, I think it's a nice attitude if the song is good, actually. I mean, actually, I don't mind the Rage Against the Machine. I mean, I'm not going to lie here. I don't listen to Rage Against the Machine on a regular basis. But if you don't like Lead Baby, there is a chance that Robbie Williams and Tyson Fury, I mean, they did a song together. I mean, if you're a fan...
What is not to enjoy about that?
Exactly.
Tyson Fury, for me, very much the embodiment of Christmas values.
I mean, to be honest, that's potentially more radical than Rage Against the Machine.
That's pretty transgressive,
By some measure.
Or you guys keep it cool. Mariah Carey is celebrating 25 years of All I Want for Christmas Is You, which, again, could be number one again.
Okay. All great options. I'm going to have my fingers crossed for Tyson Fury, I think.
Or we can go to the cinema instead.
Let's seek refuge in the dark of the multiplex.
The same day on Friday, three big films will be released. And I think there's a little bit for everyone. Maybe not for you, Og, perhaps, from the films I chose. But, you know, I hope... Tell me your favorite from those three that I'm going to mention to you. We have Cats... I'm curious to see Judi Dench as a cat and wearing like a fur coat on top of it. And then you have Bombshell, which is based on Roger Ailes from Fox News and is the first film actually about the Me Too scandal. It's interesting because the reviews so far haven't been that great. I haven't seen the film yet, but you know, Nicole Kidman is in there, Charlize Theron.
I watched the TV adaptation Faye with Naomi Watts, which was... very interesting in terms of it had its fractured chronology, it didn't follow on, it just jumped episodically through. An extraordinary performance from Russell Crowe, but it has that feeling of maybe being a little after the Lord Mayor Show, this release, but I'll be interested to see that one.
Especially if you've seen the TV series to compare. And then the final one is the big blockbuster of the season, which is Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, which apparently, is it the last one? Probably, I'm sure they will create a new trilogy after that, no?
We can only hope that it's the last.
Which one would you guys go to the cinema?
You are right, Faye. I have zero interest in any of those. I think they all sound completely tedious. Probably the Bombshell one, because I just Googled it and it looks like the only one that might have
of
merit.
If I was able to send Org to one of them, it would definitely be Cats.
I would do the same.
And I would very much like to read or listen to the review that he made of it.
I would rather go and see Cats than The Last Jedi. I find the Star Wars films desperately boring. They all put me to sleep.
On that note, I might have to agree with you.
I'm glad that we found common ground. What's our last story, Faye?
Well, our last story, actually, you guys touched on this topic already. On Saturday, the 21st of December, something's called Super Saturday. Don't worry, it's not the US elections, but it's the busiest shopping day for Christmas. So that's the day where people actually will go out. And you were talking about forward planning. Usually I leave things for last minute, but this year I've been, you know, pretty good. You know, before I go to my travels to Brazil, I got some requests of cigars and vinyls. So that has been ordered. So I feel very efficient this year.
But you see, that's telling. So you just got straight on the old internet. You've not been hitting the bricks and mortar retail outlets, Fernando.
Actually, I feel very bad saying this, but the vinyls, they were only available online. But the cigars, don't worry. I went to Piccadilly, I bought them in person.
Excellent.
I felt very chic doing that.
Are you not worried that you're giving the game away?
No.
Okay, good. Well, Faye, thanks so much for joining us. It's been really great. Happy Christmas, I guess.
Merry Christmas. Feliz Natal.
Thank you, Faye. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Listener, in a moment we'll be hearing from Dan Behar, better known under his musical alias, Destroyer.
Since the mid-90s, musician Dan Behar has been bringing out albums under the name Destroyer over the years, 12 albums to date. His sound's changed away from aesthetic anti-musicality towards something different. at the same time nostalgic and forward-looking, Behar offsets lyricism, dense with imagery, against musical space.
Behar's 2011 album Kaput introduced him to a wider audience, myself included. Informal, funny and compelling, it marked a change for the artist, not least in how it was recorded. Some of his louche, relaxed vocals were famously laid down while he was horizontal, lying on the sofa.
Next month, Behar's releasing his 13th album as Destroyer. Have We Met sees him engage with his back catalogue of lyrical jottings to bring forth new songs. He sat down with Org to explain more about his working processes, meaning, and why some of these vocals were recorded sitting at the kitchen table.
You know, some of them just came out as they always do, which is just me kind of walking around in a fog, and a phrase and a melody will hit me. A couple of them, though, were more my old style of writing, which was, you know, cramming notebooks filled with words and then grabbing some of those words and sticking them to music, which is something I hadn't really done in like 10 or 12 years. For some reason, I felt the need to go back to that for a couple of songs, like the first song, for instance. Otherwise, it's just me messing around on my computer and sending it to a friend who messes around with it even more and then getting another friend to blaze guitar all over it. You know, same old.
You were just talking about that kind of lyrical density, the notebook's full. Is that kind of free associative stuff? Do you write with around meaning? Is that a helpful sort of framework to think about your lyrics through?
I mean, I don't really know how other people do it. I know the things that don't interest me, which are characters, stories, psychology. I don't really know what's left after that. Whatever's left after that is the stuff I write about. But I get, you know, like a kick out of language, I guess. And it's not just the sound it makes. So I always think if it sounds good, it means it has some kind of emotional resonance or, you know, emotional meaning, which is all you really try and do, especially in music, you know, is get to people. I'm not like a puzzle maker or something.
It seems like images seem to come up as well. There's like a very visual quality to songwriting.
Yeah, that's my favorite. I guess like try and write in a filmic kind of way, but cut out all the fat, the dross, like you guys would say. You know, just have really short 10-second scenes and string them together into a 4-minute song.
Have you ever written any movie soundtracks?
No, no, I haven't. But it interests me. Yeah. I would have to get someone to really help me, but I like having short motifs which get expanded through something or have like endless variations on a few melodic themes, like in Last Tango in Paris.
How does it come then to when you're working with like David Galloway, who directed your video for Crimson Tide, which is off the forthcoming album you've worked with in the past? What's that relationship like if you kind of already have this image map in your head?
Right. I have to actually, I'm very hands-off with all the video stuff just because I'm a little bit of a film obsessive and I find like I won't, you know, once I get in there, I'll be just too intrusive. It works much better if I'm just told to go stand in a place and do a certain thing for a certain amount of time, you know, clear cut. Also, I'm really suspect of the music video format still. So instead of me wrestling with whether it's completely corrupt or not, it's better just to like, for me to think of myself as like a hired actor.
I was like the laziest river, a vulture predisposed to eating off floors. No, wait, I take that back. I was more like an ocean stuck inside hospital corridors. My condition in general, despite what they say, improves.
I think they can be good. They can be art. I just like, maybe because of my age, I still struggle around the idea of taking them seriously. And there was a good chunk of time, it felt like, in music, at least in North America, where it was besides the point, and then they kind of came back. So it's interesting to make them. I don't mind it, and I don't give it too much thought. But yeah, I can't get too involved on the creative end, because I'll just come up with too many schemes.
I guess music videos kind of, they sort of started, didn't they, in the 80s? Is that when MTV came about, and Thatcherism and Reaganism in America, and it was this kind of hyper-neoliberal environment. I was reading a review of your album, Ken, your last album, that draws parallels, certainly aesthetic parallels, between the synth pop sound that you had on that album and the sound of that time. And it then also draws political parallels. This is 2017 and the 1980s, and uses that to explore the sense of paranoia that comes through on the album. I wondered, you know, first of all, what your reflections are on that, and second, like, given I don't think it feels like the 80s anymore. Not that I remember the 80s. It feels like something completely different. But whether that sense of paranoia, is it growing more acute?
I don't know. You know, I think I was thinking about that time mostly for personal reasons, because I was thinking that just happens to be when I was a teenager. I suspected that was when my music tastes were fully formed. And after that, it became something else. Definitely, I draw some weird line between when I was just a rabid music fan and when I was someone who was trying to write songs and make music as a kind of before and after. And a lot of that music I just put on the shelf for 30 years as some kind of like fraudulent decision that it was juvenile or not something serious or just part of my youth. Or just because it's something that I fell out of touch with, but records I still had and I put them on. I'm like, man, this affects me, and it all has this veneer that I couldn't put into words. And I was just wondering if it had something to do with that time, that political climate. And, you know, you always try and think about things in current terms, you know, like what does this record mean here and now? But all the writing for that record, for instance, came before the kind of like sonic concept for it. There's always kind of a pretty clear divide of like a bunch of writing that I'll spew out and is quite intuitive. And I don't know exactly where it comes from. And it seldomly has like holds a theme from beginning to end. Or maybe it does and I'm just not far away from it enough yet to know what that is. So I think that stuff that you were talking about was more just like the aesthetics of a certain political era, more than like me drawing lines between what dread felt like then, whether it was like nuclear dread, and what dread feels like now, which is some wholly other beast, you know?
Mm. What's the process? Because, you know, I was just thinking about it then. If you're writing music for films or if you're writing songs that have films in them, if you're writing in one medium for a different sense, that seems like maybe there's something, there's quite a weird connection between those two things. I suppose it's a bit like being an illustrator, where you don't want to be too literal, but I can imagine there being a similar sort of disconnect between text, between having this block of text that you've written that, as you say, is kind of intuitive, and then like giving it meaning musically.
Yeah.
What's that kind of process like? How do you, I mean, is it trial and error? Is it like, is it also an intuitive thing?
For me, that's like the music part, like the giving this, the bare bones of the song, some kind of form in the world is always the struggle. It's always been where the labor is, maybe because I'm not a natural, while the words and melody kind of come very intuitively, almost like in a physical way, where I just know when I'm mumbling it whether I feel good about it or not. And the rest is like imposing ideas and like structure on that thing that just came to you. Sometimes you feel like you nailed it, and sometimes time goes by and you're like, I don't know if that's really like the perfect form for that song. But I mean, that's part of the mystery and the fun of it. There's always been a huge disconnect in Destroyer songs between my presence and what I'm saying and the musical background. I think that's kind of part of what I've played with. Even though I like kind of melancholic chord structures and melodies, they tend to want to go to, I don't know, like people's pleasure points. That's why sometimes it gets confused for pop music, while the lyrics try and do everything they can to avoid pop music at all costs, like Poison, because I just don't get lyric like inspiration from that kind of language. For the most part, there's always exceptions, and that's why I'm super confused about it still after like 23 years.
That seems to kind of be expressed in the tension that I hear, again, between the density of the lyrics and the space of the music. How do you think about space in music?
It's changed, you know. It's probably been my main struggle. Like when I started off for the first many Destroyer albums, it was just cramming words in there because I don't know if I felt like I had a lot to say, but I felt like having a rush of images that you can't spit out fast enough was part of the music. And in some ways, it was like very combative with the music. And then there was kind of a shift. I did this one record called Kaput a few years ago, and that was a kind of a conscious effort. I mean, not that conscious, because I don't really know how to sit down and write something. I don't make those kind of decisions that at that ground zero, but for there to be more space for the music, for the words to be less in your face and kind of more integrated into what you're hearing, to be something that could like be played as ambience or like in a public space, or something that you could put on while eating dinner without having someone wanting to take it off, because before that was a big part of what I did, which was like, you need to reckon with the voice and the words, and it's not going to work at a dinner party or something. I haven't really gone back to making a record like that, but it's interesting to see how it works, you know?
One of the kind of famous stories that I remember about Caput was that you recorded a lot of the vocal parts while you were lying down, relaxed. And I was just reading in the press notes for Have We Met that some of the lyrics were recorded kind of around a kitchen table. At first, I just wanted to fact check that. But I also wanted to ask about the way that feeling of domesticity and intimacy leaches out into the music.
I would say with Caput, we were really focused on me not having like four whiskeys and then stepping up to the microphone and orating. I definitely, before that, had cultivated kind of an insane preacher style. And so with Caput, I was just basically just did scratch vocals, which in the biz is like placeholders that then you're going to do for real. But then for the most part, we just stuck with them because that was like one trick for making me sound like a relaxed, normal human being. With Have We Met, I took that one step further, and that's why it's my favorite singing that I think I've done. With the new record, I just recorded all the skeletons for the songs at home and then sent them to John Collins, who produced the record and pretty much remixed everything. And, you know, it was me at 1 o'clock in the morning sitting on my living room table singing quietly into my computer, usually with like, even the lyrics in front of me, like what you hear on the album is me singing those songs for the first or second time ever in my life, right? Just figuring out how they go, thinking when we get a concrete idea of what the music's supposed to be, I'll redo it later, which never happened. I think that anchors the album in a way that I want to keep trying to do, you know? It's probably like the most poorly recorded vocals that have ever been on a Destroyer album. They're really technically just bad, which forced us, which was a good thing, to just put insane effects on things just to make them bearable. But I like how little attention we paid to the vocals, considering what I'm doing in the band is supposed to be like supposedly an integral thing. I think we spent more time, you know, on what like fake hi-hats sounded like.
You're looking good in spite of the light and the air and the time of the night. They play your favorite song. She's just too dark to care. High water everywhere. Smoke gets in your eyes.
And it's not cool to say this these days, but I feel like the band has been superseding album versions of the songs for, you know, 10 years now. That sounds like I'm saying the albums are crappy. They're not. They're good. But I just still am old-fashioned, and I dig getting in a room with seven people who just blaze.
Thanks to Dan Behar, and his new album as Destroyer, titled Have We Met, will be out at the end of January. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. It's time for some music now. We just heard from Dan Behar, aka Destroyer, so why not dip into his back catalogue and head back to that 2011 album, Caput. This is Chinatown.
The way the wind's talking to the sea, I heard that someone said it before. I don't care, I can't walk away, I can't walk away in Chinatown.
That was Chinatown by Destroyer. This is The Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Konnichiwa. For its bumper December-January issue, Monocle heads to Japan and delivers a guide to a fascinating nation with an exciting year ahead. Here are five top picks from what you'll find inside. First, meet Kumamon, the furry mascot that's the darling of Kumamoto Prefecture thanks to its infectious brand of soft power. Second, we take to the skies with Mitsubishi Aircraft Corporation as the company releases the first aircraft to be designed and built in Japan in decades. Third, we look ahead to the stadiums, venues and developments that will host next year's Olympics and prove this country's architectural sensibility still has plenty to teach to the rest of the world. 4th, we drop into the new London outpost of Snowpeak, the brand bringing its cool camping kit to urbanites keen to escape the concrete jungle. 5th, we lead you on a whistle-stop tour of all the shops, neighbourhoods and cities you should hit up for a successful Christmas spree. From hats to wooden toys, candle holders to ceramics, we've got your present list sorted. Monocle's December-January issue is available now at monocle.com. Never miss a copy. Head to the website and subscribe now.
It's not unusual to hear of people retraining mid-career these days, is it? Journalists become teachers while others discover art in their retirement. Our next guest, however, has made about as abrupt a U-turn as is possible.
Until 2015, Philip Hum was the CEO of Vodafone Europe, but he traded that in to make a go of his true passion, art. He's a painter, sculptor, and now filmmaker. He's just made a cinematic adaptation of Goethe's Faust, part of a Gesamtkunstwerk that will cast the great work of German literature in a new contemporary light.
If that sounds like an ambitious undertaking, you're not wrong. I sat down with Philip, as well as his Faust, Martin Hancock, to learn more about his career shift and what on earth drew him to the timeless tale of a man who sells his soul.
I'm one of these few people who have two talents, one, and I was already at school, one is for art and the other one for mathematics. And I started out when I was ended school, wanted to go to art school, failed at the first go, and then moved into business where I had a successful career. So art was then more on the back burner, but always there. And then later, which was basically when my kids were out of the house, I started having the idea to moving back into art. But it was a very daunting perspective to really go all the way, even if we have presidents like Gauguin and others who right now on display here. So one day I said to myself, look, you are still relatively speaking young, not compared to you, obviously, but relatively young. You now have to decide to either go full-time and really be serious about it or to keep it as a hobby. And I said, no, I want to go for it full-time. That's really where my passion is. And so I jumped in 2015 and left basically everything behind. And I'm an optimist, so I believe I have still another 30 years to produce. So from that point of view, I think it still makes sense to take the decision now. The film part was really a little bit something which grew super organically. We never started The Last Faust with the idea to create a film. The idea was to have, let's say, stage scenes with actors, and so that I could use that to do my paintings. That was a starting point. And then I met an amazing CGI artist who showed me some of his work. So I started working with him, and we developed the idea to make out of it a whole photo collection. The film was at the beginning more like the idea of having a behind the scenes, and then somehow it evolved week after week after week, and then we ended up at the end with a full feature-length art film, and at the core, a theatre play.
It does feel very theatrical, you know. There's a lot of artifice that you can see in it. People are meant to be flying, but they're suspended from wires. The sets are kind of flat in a way that cinematically maybe is not so normal. Martin, have you worked in theatre and in art? Was it a new step for you?
It wasn't a new step. No, it was the most committed I've done. Hmm. In the past, I've done work with the Toy Factory. I did a collaborative work with them called Hoover Bag years ago, which was part installation, part theatre. And I've done some blatantly weird films in the past, which are great because obviously I've done a lot of commercial film and a lot of commercial TV, but it's a real antidote to go off and do something that's good old fashioned out there. Mm. And this was. Philip looks like a very calm, rational man, but then he shows you what he actually wants to do and you think, okay, maybe not. Still waters run deep. Yeah, and it was very strange. I mean, you mentioned the fact that it's a very flat set that we worked on. We worked on essentially a stage set that was projected onto as well. So there's real constraints about movement. You had to treat it as a theatre piece, but you were even restrained within that because you couldn't step into the projections because you'd screw up a lot of really good art. So there were these constraints, but at the same time, because there's these constraints, it freed you up a bit to make choices. You know, maybe not all of them the right choices, but I made choices. That was brilliant. It was a very different way of working, and I really enjoyed it.
So Philip wasn't cracking the whip, choreographing it to within an inch?
There's an element of cracking the whip. Yes, it's like all filming. If you take two steps the wrong way, then you've just ruined a day's setup. It's not completely free. But at the same time, Philip was an incredibly laid-back maestro. He's just very nice to work for. I'm not saying that because he's sitting opposite me. He's just a genuinely nice person to work for.
Philip, I'd like to ask a bit about the filmmaking in a sec. But first, you know, I was interested in the choice of Faust. I mean, people know it, obviously, in the UK and I think in Anglophone countries. But I think it has a resonance in Germany that it doesn't here.
Yeah.
Why did you sort of engage with that story to this extent? And how did you see its resonance? Was it obvious to you from the get-go?
If you want, I always, from what I do in my art, it's always about narrative arts. So it's always about a message, right? So I like this idea that art needs to say something, to change something, to be vocal in society. So I liked also painters like, for example, Paolo Arrego, who are illustrative narrative painters. And I went 2016 to an exhibition of Dali in Florence, where he basically did a full illustration of Dante's Divine Comedy. And that was something where I said, wow, that's just amazing, because it's a different way of telling a story, right, than what you can do in writing. So I had the idea, I want to do something similar. And being half German, but having grown up in a French school environment, I felt always the need to learn more about also the German culture. So I knew Faust 1, but I didn't really know Faust 2. But I said, Faust could potentially be a book, because the basic underlying theme of Faust, right, the bet with the devil to on one hand get access to unlimited knowledge, but selling your soul to the same time, and this interplay is something we do every day, and that's a very modern theme. So I said, the theme is interesting. And then I started reading Faust 2 and discovered that Faust 2 is super interesting as a text. And then it was clear to me that this is what I wanted to do then, the whole artwork on. And so that was the starting point.
I interviewed someone recently about a book called Don't Be Evil, which kind of takes a very critical look at big tech. Mm-hmm. And it opened up with a quotation from Frankenstein. And that seems like quite a powerful sort of parallel to be drawing between, you know, these huge figures like from Zuckerberg to Peter Thiel or whoever and Frankenstein, this idea that the monster has kind of changed. But do you think that Faust offers just as good a sort of metaphor, a framework through which to view our relationship with kind of technology today?
Yeah, I think it's, let's say, Faust is multifaceted. Faust is, let's say, the person who today, in today's world, would lead a Silicon Valley company and is every day doing a bet on society. And as we're moving into technologies now, which are becoming less and less controllable, like AI-based technologies or genetic-based technologies, all these are very big changing technologies. We are moving into a world where humanity is putting itself at risk. But why? Because humanity is so curious that it can't stop to one day put itself at risk. You could argue maybe that's for the better, because the planet might be quite happy about it, right? But there is simply this inherent thing which right now is on an exponential curve, because there are so many technologies out there which have a devastating power, very different to the parents' days where there was only nuclear technology. So I think there is this aspect. But that there is at the same time the human Faust. And the human Faust, who is basically a person who aspires to knowledge, but then gets pulled down into lust, which is also, if you take, for example, a Weinstein, right? It's a person who has, nobody had more Oscars than he had. And at the same time, he was going for whatever, in an ugly way, after women, right? So you have this juxtaposition, which in the person of Faust is kind of brought to an extreme. And that makes a character interesting, because he has this contradiction in himself. And when you work with a character, you do not identify yourself the same way as if you were like Gary Grant and you say, oh, I want to be Gary Grant and all perfect. But you kind of look at him and you say, yeah, he's somebody I need to work with and I need to understand. But I still have a distance, right? I identify, but I have a distance, right? So it's a very interesting character to work with.
Martin, what are your reflections on Faust? Was he a kind of easy character to empathize with? It seems like there's something very depressing about the sort of inevitability of corruption that he kind of represents. Was it something that you could get on board with?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, this is, which is the whole point of Faust, really.
Yeah.
You very soon realise as you start digging into him that you don't want to be Faust. I don't. I mean, there are Fausts out there. We've spoken about this before, the dot-com billionaires who 1 billion's not enough. They want more, they want more, they want more. They live these really strange artificial lives because they have no connection with humanity. They have no connection with the everyday trials and tribulations that we all have, apart from perhaps their own emotions, their own very, very inner circle. But even then, how much of that inner circle is a genuine inner circle? They become men apart, which is perhaps what they wanted to be. Whether that's something that we should all strive for, I don't think it is. And I think ultimately, Faust cuts a very sad figure and a rather pathetic figure in the end, because it's only at the end, when the Marxist ideology comes forward, that he starts to realise what pleasure is in man and man's interaction with man. And that's where joy is. What separates us from two amoebas is we interact with each other, we bounce off each other, we have an imagination which feeds another person's imagination, and we work. So, no, Faust is a strange one. We're all very hungry, but too much hunger, I think, is a bad thing.
Yeah, and that separation that you describe, I mean, this is sort of more anecdotal, but isn't it Elon Musk is convinced that we live in a computer-simulated world? It seems to breed a death of empathy itself, right? It's like it generates an environment where there's...
Well, this is the other thing that we're dealing with now, I think, more and more and more, is that empathy... The ability to empathise with other people, genuinely empathise, even if you disagree with them, that's going. It's gone. We're living in a binary world of dots and ones and zeros. And it's showing. Technology is beginning to affect us rather than us affect technology. You know, artificial intelligence is one aspect of that. But then there's also our emotional intelligence. And I think we're becoming emotionally less intelligent the more technological we become.
Is that something you kind of are on board with?
I mean, if you want, the logical evolution of everything right now is that humans and machines will merge over time. The question is, if they merge over time, that the question is whether humans will at all, as a race, survive. Right? Because technically speaking, if, for example, people talk a lot about AI, but everybody talks about AI today, but there is no AI today, because the only thing which exists today is very fast processing computers, but still binary computers, zero and one. That's all they can do. Not only Google has released, but the quantum computer from Google has released itself, that it's now able to do full calculations in a few minutes, which the fastest computer would take, I don't know, a few thousand years to do. So now we are moving into the reality of AI, which means self-learning. So the question will be, as the things are merging, right, AI is one dimension, bionics is the other, which part is now mine, which one is replaced? The old days was simple, was only the tooth, right? Now every part becomes replaceable more and more. And so it becomes one element. And the question is, will simply humanity disappear in a network? Or will the network just eliminate humanity at one point in time? But it's very difficult to see a different, more optimistic outcome of it, because we're all working in the same direction. And how do you stop that?
Thanks to Philip Hum and his film The Last Faust. It's available now on streaming services. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
For a celebration of all things print, tune in to The Stack, every week on Monocle 24, featuring expert analysis, the view of magazine veterans, and a look at what's flying off newsstands around the world. The Stack goes beyond the headlines to reveal the inner workings of the print industry.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. We decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Listen to The Stack and hear Fernando Augusto Pacheco in conversation with our favourite editors. And get the latest industry insights from our own editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, airs every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup, live or on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Finally today, we'll continue with our explorations of the spiritual as we meet author, priest and therapist Marie Elsa Bragg.
The Western world seems particularly spiritually moribund at the moment. So with Christmas coming up, Monocle's Chloe Ashby sat down with Mary Elsa to ask more about contemporary spirituality and to learn more about her new book, Sleeping Letters.
I was actually supposed to write a different book. I was commissioned to write something else. But when I got to a silent retreat, which I went on to write, because I seem to be on a scale. Some people are brilliant planners. I envy that. But I'm quite an unconscious writer. So I went on to this silent retreat and it felt very strongly that this was what was going to come out and I was going to have to get it out, get it over with and move through it. It was the time. And really what it was just being able to process a tragedy that had happened to my family when I was six and be able to kind of look at everything I'd found and push really against my idea of God, my faith, and use everything that I'd gathered and really work out how you come through something like that. It's no accident my father's 80 now, and I think I wanted to be able to give it to him before he leaves. I'm sure he's got another 10 or 20 years, but it was really a kind of pivotal moment. A lot of his friends are going, and I just felt it's a love letter, really, and it's a plea for healing. And it's daring, looking at myself and looking at God and saying, you know, do we have to have a fantasy to survive this? Do we have to fake it to survive? Or can we really go through the eye of the needle? I'm not interested in fantasy spirituality, I want to know. So there I went.
And I noticed quite early on in the memoir that you refer to it as a confession.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I think it feels confessional just being there in the silent retreat. It's very intimate. I didn't write it to be published. I wrote it to go through it. I'm from a very creative spiritual tradition. Not only did I train with the Jesuits to do the silent retreat, which uses imaginative contemplation, and I'm training to be a Jungian analyst, which is very interested in dreams and active imagination, but you know, I'm from both sides of my family. Cumbria is very creative. Everyone knows about Ireland having very creative spirituality, but we're creative Celts in Cumbria too. So doing something like writing or painting or walking or is kind of natural to me, to my culture. So I think it was that, and I think it was confessing to myself as a woman what I was inherently part of as a child. And obviously you don't have any choice when you're a child in a way, but as a woman, you look back and realise you're part of things you might not have wanted to be part of. And confessing that I really love them both. It's been hard. And confessing to myself that life is, and that's okay. It's hard and beautiful together. That's the way it is, will always be. I think just feeling kind of naked in front of God, just allowing myself to feel honourably seen, fully seen, in silence. Silence has always been traditionally, you know, people go to the desert to face themselves, face whatever this short life is about. And I wanted to turn around and face that properly, truthfully.
And do you think it's possible today to embrace silence without the framework of a retreat? Because it seems that with so much to do and to see, it would require a huge amount of self-discipline, much like writing and faith.
Mm, that's such a good question.
Thank you.
I hope so. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need a religious framework, but you need some kind of a framework. You know, I have a lot of friends who are steeped in nature, for instance, and that's where their spirituality is. Beth Cathedral, top of a mountain, or in a valley with an incredible lake. And of course, the old, you know, Christian mystics found that as well. It's not for no reason that they built their hermitages on islands in the middle of lakes and things. So for them, you know, going for a big pilgrimage on the fells where other people have walked before them, following the Wainwright walks, or following an old path that may have been a place of pilgrimage for generations, but they're doing it in their own way. And it's really the elements and the landscape and the change every day that holds them. If they see that as a structure, then that gives them the sense of silence. There are lots of ways of finding it, but I think the gift is that traditions can give is to show us that it is to be found. There is an art, there's a craft to it, and it's something to pass on. And every generation has to make it their own, so it doesn't have to be the exact religious way that your grandparents did. But if we get to walk somehow in that track, and pass it on to our children and our grandchildren, then we're at allowing each of us to build on giant shoulders, as they say, because you can only do so much in one life.
And as an author and a priest, do you feel that the two feed into one another? How do they diverge?
Oh, that's another really good question. I'm just walking along an honest path with whatever I do. I can't really separate them out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if writing in itself could be seen as an act of faith, especially with such an honest book.
For me, it's, yes, an act of faith, yes. But I would say an act of faith for me is also an act of having courage to question faith. I think there must be room for doubt, just like in any really good poem. Mm-hmm. You've got to be able to return to it many times and not understand it and have space between the words. And if any faith or any path is worth anything, it's going to serve you for a lifetime and be able to change with you. And in that lifetime, you'll come across all manner of faith and doubt and regret and hope. And I think that's important. Dogma's wonderful. It's electric. It's an incredible alchemical philosophy that we all need to have engage with if we want to and think about. But once we make it static and distant and elite and not applicable to everything that's really happening here, then we lose the poetry, and you lose the poetry at your peril, I think.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of what's happening here, so we're sitting here the day after the election in the UK. How would you describe the current state of spirituality?
In the country?
In the country.
Oh, alongside the day after the election, it's interesting. It's like a wind has blown through the country. I think a lot of people are making a bid to clear the ground. And I think a lot of people are making a bid to reclaim their identity and their place in the country and their tradition. Spirituality at the moment is very interesting. I mean, obviously, there's a very strong evangelical movement but I think I work with a lot of people who are exploring. But there's a really interesting creative spirituality coming out, beginning to come out in literature, like Marilyn Robinson, you know, and in poetry, you have Alice Oswald and you know, David Harsent, and with his Fire Songs, and Michael Simmons-Smith with his Psalter. And you have really interesting people who are distant enough from it to be able to be creative with it again. Then there's a really interesting movement, for instance, the Extinction Rebellion movement. Let's look at that for a second. To my mind, they remind me of the kind of Christian socialists in the early 1900s who were really kind of built a whole new world of community and equality. And a lot of people I know in the Extinction Rebellion movement have a real sense of spirituality and legacy and overview, trying to change the way that we do things, a real sense of building community. And these are things that spirituality can give us, a sense of overview, whatever method it is. And I meet a lot of people who've explored shamanism, for instance. That's a very big thing at the moment. You know, they're off exploring with ayahuasca or doing enormous journeys, imaginative journeys, and then I meet them for spiritual direction, and you know, they want to understand how it's affecting their psyche or what these experiences are and how to integrate them. And I think that a lot of people really want to find something honest and true and creative, and I think that's a wonderful thing. The danger, of course, is that if you don't have a body of knowledge of how to hold it in a really good, healthy way and integrate it all, then you can be lost picking and choosing and having the different highs and actually suddenly find yourself stranded, which I come across a lot. So I'm not saying that there's one way to deal with it, but I am saying that from my perspective, and you might say I have to say this, but from my perspective, we are physical, psychological and spiritual beings, and each part of us must be honoured and taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And in each part of living, there is a craft, and there are generations of teachings to be passed on to everyone of how to hold that and how to grow with that and be part of a family and a community growing with that.
So returning to your craft as an author, the book is like a collage. It's pieced together with prose, poetry, religious rituals, letters. I'm curious whether you sat down and wrote it from start to finish or whether the style enabled you to dip in and out.
No, I wrote it on a week, you know, bit by bit, day by day, with the Eucharist on 2 silent retreats, except for the hour poems, which came after the second retreat when I was walking in the mountains in France. I was feeling like that I didn't know how to be with the silence after the Eucharist. And all the times that I've spent in, monasteries, nunneries, suddenly the hours of prayer came through, and they all came through quite quickly.
Mm.
But it was interesting because when I asked my publishers for an extension for the book I was asked to write, and I said, I have been writing, and they said, OK, well, show us what you're writing so that we can see where, you know, what you're doing, and you can have the year. So I said, great. When we sat around the table and I said, actually, we'd really like to publish it, do you think you could bear that? Because it's so, you know, my heart and soul is completely in that. It's every ounce of love and soul that I have to give to my parents or to get through what I was writing is most definitely there. I thought for a moment, well, should I separate out the poetry and the prose and how do I... But then I thought, well, it is what it is. And the Eucharist came in like that to hold me. I think, for me, I don't think I would have been able to get through it without having a sense, an intricate sense of the ritual of the Eucharist, the doing of it. So somehow that bringing it down to earth, something so mystical, bringing it down to earth and being able to go through that alongside me was a real companion.
Mm. The election result has shown that social fault lines in the UK might run deeper than they've appeared. And it's a pattern we see repeated abroad as well. Culture undoubtedly bears part of the responsibility for this. Do you think creative spirituality can bridge the gaps that have opened up in society?
I think it's really important. Let's make a bid for authentic writing. I think there's a creative movement afoot. Let people write what they really feel. Let a culture come back to life. Let's write about authentic leadership, about what's deep down. Let's counter the culture. Let's take away celebrity and look at what is deeper inside a person and ask that person to not lead on their own, but lead alongside everyone else. Let people write, sing, paint, and let's say that all of these are equal languages and always have been equal languages when we build a culture that honours us and that we're proud of. I think that there's a real chance here. There's a real movement here. And if we allow this creativity, which is what, you know, what we're saying is what allows a sense of space to accept everybody, then maybe what we're seeing today is the ground rumbling for a real renewal. And maybe we'll all do that in our own, in different ways, and join accepting different types and different creativity along the way.
Thanks to Chloe Ashby and Marie Elsa Bragg. And Marie Elsa's book, Sleeping Letters, is out now. You're with the Monocle Weekly, just. That was great. Didn't you enjoy that? It's nice to be back in the Studio One with you on a Sunday.
Indeed. There's no better way to spend one Sunday lunchtime. Forget your family. You want to be here on the weekly. I must say, Org, after that programme, I feel... I can only describe a feeling of spiritual enlightenment.
Me too, man. I can't wait for Christmas. I'm looking forward to singing some carols even more than I had been previously. Which was a lot, actually.
Good. I'm glad too. I'm also glad... at the tidings brought by the people behind the glass, Org, yourself, the producer of the show, of course, and our studio manager, Maylee Evans. The Weekly will be back at the same time next week for more festive cheer and seasonal frolics, so do be sure to tune in for that.
But for now, it's goodbye from me, Augustin Macellari.
And from me, Tom Edwards. Goodbye and thanks for listening.